This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to speak to John Abramson, who's with Harvard Medical School, and his position there is, well, you tell us. Welcome to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Pleasure to be with you, Mark. I'm a clinical instructor in primary care at Harvard Medical School and family doc. I practiced family medicine for 20 years in a small town about 45 minutes north of Boston. And for the past 3 years have been working on this book, Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine.
And what's the central thesis of that book?
The central thesis comes out of my own experience as a family doc, which is that increasingly the information that's available to the doctors, even the doctors who are most disciplined about getting the best information, is coming through commercial filters so that the clinical research is being sponsored by the drug companies. The influence of drug companies on the publications and the journals is growing. The clinical guidelines that we follow have become dominated by experts with financial ties to drug companies that that have drugs that are currently being decided upon, and clinical continuing education is dominated by drug and medical device companies. So the bottom line is that when I'm trying to take care of my patients, what is going on in that exam room, which in my mind ought to be nearly sacred in its dedication to benefiting the patient and the patient's health, is now largely taken over by the knowledge that guides that interaction is now largely taken over by commercial interests, and its primary purpose is to increase corporate profits rather than to best improve my patient's health.
Now, from what we said before we started recording, you're not averse to drug companies making profits, but what is it that you are opposed to them being?
I'm not at all averse to drug companies making profits. I think that we can harness the ingenuity of the incentives of capitalism so that we continue to get more better products. The problem is that the drug companies are now earning 3 to 4 times the rate of return on their sales that the other Fortune 500 industries are earning.
That's more or less in the 17-18%.
18%, right, and the other companies vary between 3-5%, the average of the other companies. The issue is that the drug companies can make that kind of profit without making products that provide a commensurate social value. So the problem is that we don't have any way to oversee the quality of the medical knowledge that upon which docs and patients base their medical decisions.
Okay, now there have been some proposals about doing that. In fact, a consortium of medical journals just announced that it would no longer publish results of tests unless it had gotten registration of those tests from the people doing it at the beginning. Is that a good idea?
Exactly. It's a good idea, and the movement to post all results are a good idea, but the op-ed piece that I had published in the New York Times on September 18th addresses this issue. Neither of those are going to be sufficient. When we look at registration, an article was published in a journal called the Archives of General Psychiatry in 2000. The researchers obtained all the studies that the FDA considered, quote, pivotal, meaning good enough to include in their decision-making process, all of the studies that had been done on the newer antidepressants between 1987 and 1997 were obtained under a Freedom of Information Act request. When those studies are compiled, we find that the newer antidepressants are less effective than the older antidepressants. They're about 8% more effective than placebo in the longer-term studies, which means the 8-week studies. But the suicide risk of the people taking the newer antidepressants in these studies is higher than the people taking the placebos, so that out of 1,000 people treated with a newer antidepressant, 4.6 more will kill themselves each year than if they had been treated with a placebo for their depression.
So the fact is that the previous generation, which were called tricyclic antidepressants,
yes,
they work just as well or better than the current generation of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Yeah, they're a little
inhibitors,
bit more effective.
And they didn't have any noticeable increase in suicidality in the people who
they
took
had
them.
Some increase, but what we've been led to believe, as what we clinicians have been led to believe, is that the tricyclic dangerous because when they're taken as an overdose, they create arrhythmias, and that's true. But the bottom line is that the people who take the newer antidepressants are more likely than the people who take the older antidepressants. So the point that I'm making here is that those results, were available in 2000 as if all those studies had been registered.
Right.
Because they were, all the studies were obtained from the FDA.
So you're saying, well, it's a good idea to do registration. It's not sufficient.
It's not sufficient because it doesn't get, what we need to do is have this information get into doctors' and patients' awareness in a way that it becomes the basis of their clinical decision making. Right now, we've got commercially biased information as the basis of clinical decision making.
Part of that involves all of this millions of dollars of television advertising with cute little Zoloft characters and so on, with people being really bad and depressed and unhappy, and then they take the drug, and then they're great and happy, and they have wonderful lives. And then people go in, and at the end it says, "Go ask your doctor for some of this."
Right. And what happens is these new antidepressants. Very little effectiveness for mild depression, and yet what the advertisements are doing is getting people who do have what we would define, even though it can be quite unpleasant, to go ask their doctors. What happens is the relationship between the doctor and the patient gets undermined because the discussion now becomes taking drugs or not taking drugs instead of what's going on in somebody's life, which is usually what all this is about. This image of depression being some biomedical disorder,
right,
that has nothing to do with what's going on in the world, it happens sometimes, and it's very serious when it does, but most of our sadness comes from the way we're living our lives. And if we're going to improve, it usually requires a change in the way we're living our lives.
So both the specifics of the situation and the general idea that if something ails you, take a pill, are working to encourage people to solve what they perceive as problems through medication rather than by changing the way they live.
Right. It just circumvents Mother Nature's wisdom. For example, there was a nice study that was done on one of the antidepressants with people who had social anxiety disorder.
Right.
And it was a 2x2 study, so it wasn't just take the antidepressant or don't take the antidepressant, but it was take the antidepressant, don't take the antidepressant, and get counseling from a general practitioner or not get counseling from a general practitioner. And what turned out was that the antidepressant helps in the short term, but in the longer term, after the antidepressant goes away, the people who got the counseling continued to improve, whether or not they took the antidepressant, they continued to improve, showing that a big part of the problem with social anxiety disorder is just a pattern of reaction, and that people can learn how to change that pattern of reaction. But if they're treated with an antidepressant, they may lose their motivation to make those changes, which get at the root cause of the symptom.
So in fact, not only doesn't it solve it in the long run, but it prevents them from getting the treatment that could solve it in the long run.
Right. It would be analogous to taking a narcotic painkiller for a splinter.
Right.
You know, it'll take the pain away, but you're not going to get the splinter removed.
Right. And it could fester later, of course.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, so given that that's the power relations in the situation right now, what are you recommending that the people or the government do to remedy the situation?
Well, good question. I think, number one, people need to understand that most of their health is determined by the way they live their life. I'm not telling you news, but what I want to do is re-empower people to take control of their own health. So that, for example, we know that women who exercise regularly, don't smoke, eat a healthy diet, drink only in moderation, have a healthy body weight, have 83% less risk of heart disease than women who don't do all those things.
That's a lot. That's almost double.
No, 83%
is
5'6".
Well,
5'6".
Right, 5'6" of the weight, meaning which way does it go?
It means that you can remove 5/6 of your risk of heart disease by doing those things.
All right.
Now, but all the push is for statins, even though there's no evidence from randomized controlled studies that statins reduce women's risk of heart disease who don't already have heart disease.
And they probably have some side effects.
They certainly do, and we're hearing more and more about them. We haven't heard them about it. You know, there's not a good studies about the frequency, but we keep hearing about muscle pain and forgetfulness and so forth.
And in fact, in some cases, I would guess, I'm not intimately familiar with the statin story and situation and so on, but I would imagine that taking those drugs could sort of, I don't know, depress is too simple a word, but make you less likely to engage in some of these other healthy activities.
That's absolutely true. And what happens, cholesterol is really what we call a surrogate. And when we measure cholesterol, cholesterol itself is not a health hazard.
Right.
Cholesterol is only a health hazard to the extent that it causes causes heart disease, stroke, or whatever.
Right.
And what we've done is focused on cholesterol and lowering cholesterol as the primary approach to our heart disease prevention and health promotion. But what we know is that exercise and eating a healthy diet often don't change the cholesterol, but markedly reduce the risk of heart disease.
In fact, it's the same thing, that the cholesterol is the serotonin of the SSRIs with the statins, that the problem is this chemical imbalance, this chemical problem that can be solved with a chemical pill, and if you just take it, you'll be better.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So what kind of administrative steps are you recommending to get around this problem?
Right. What we need is there needs to be a nonprofit public sector body through which medical information goes, so that drug company information could come in. Drug company information is not necessarily tainted. In fact, the Vigor study that Merck did really contained all that we now know about Vioxx 4 years ago.
Right.
So the data itself was fine. The way it was translated into the New England Journal article, that left something to be desired. But the data itself was fine. So we need a federal body that can review all of the medical research, all of it, published and unpublished, with complete transparency, access to all the data, that can then determine what are the best medical treatments for given conditions.
Now, if before we go into more how that might be set up, isn't that what the Food and Drug Administration is supposed to be doing
now?
No,
it's not. No, well, no.
Distinguish between this new body you're talking about and the FDA as it's now constituted.
Yeah. There would be some overlap. The analysts within the FDA do wonderful work looking at this data. And if you look at the work they did for Celebrex and Vioxx both, it's just incredibly good work. Unfortunately, it's as if they were working in a soundproof room.
Right.
But that work is what we need done. We need that work done in a way that it can be collected in one place, and this is very important, be the go-to source for doctors and patients for the definition of good medical care. Because what I showed in that op-ed piece is that we had all the information about the antidepressants. It didn't change prescribing habits. We had it in 2000. Antidepressants were the most frequently prescribed class of drugs in 2001. We had all that information for Celebrex and Vioxx in 2000, 2001. It didn't change anything. It's 4 years later, almost 4 years later, that Vioxx is being taken off the market,
now,
even though we knew about the cardiovascular risk back then.
Right. Now, granted the validity of everything you just said, the reason that it had no effect on people's buying habits or doctors prescribing habits or people's using habits was that the amount of money spent to advertise these drugs as cure-alls, more or less literally, was so much greater than any expenditure of money from any nonprofit or other organization that would be out there trying to do what you're saying has to be done. Isn't
that's
that
exactly,
the problem?
That's exactly right. And to put it in concrete terms, Merck spent more advertising Vioxx in 2000 to consumers than was spent advertising Pepsi or Budweiser beer.
Okay, and so the consumption, although they didn't mix them, you know, buy Pepsi with Vioxx in it, but for the non-Pepsi, the post-Pepsi generation.
Right, right, exactly.
Well, this is well and good, it sounds like to me, but how are you going to do it if the government is, I don't want to get too simplified about this, the current government is a captive of the drug industry, how are you going to get the government, Congress and the White House, how are you going to institute a government agency that can be this kind of impartial clearinghouse and publicizer of the best-known facts if the government is under the thumb of the drug companies because of all the money they give to candidates and all the advertising they do and so on.
And the media that becomes drug-dependent.
Right.
That's absolutely the question, and I think it becomes a very simple issue. It becomes a question of how to make democracy work. Like the Jersey Girls say, democracy is hard work. The reason why I wrote this book, the reason why I stopped my family practice to write this book, is because I think the first step in getting this change accomplished is for the American people to understand that the purpose of their medical information has been taken over by commercial interests, to serve commercial interests, not to serve their health. None of this change will happen until there's enough political pressure from the informed public to make their representatives do it.
Okay. Well, again, that sounds good, but it sounds like to me, I haven't looked into it in depth, but it's my understanding that the drug companies are among the biggest contributors of any corporate sector to politicians.
That's true.
And in fact, you could even say, with a little bit of exaggeration, that the political system is drug dependent.
That's true.
In that
sense, they actually spend much more in lobbying than political. They're not number one in political contributions,
right,
but they're far and away number one in their lobbying efforts.
So where's the rehab? So where's
the
how can the political system go into rehab?
Yeah, I hate to be crassly plugging my book.
All right.
But the rehab is in people understanding the depth of this problem,
right,
and you can't understand it without reading somebody who's put the time in to show how the magicians do their tricks.
Right.
Everyone has a sense that there's something wrong.
Right.
But until you understand how profoundly wrong it is, how the advisors to the FDA are getting paid by the drug companies, how full-time employees at the National Institutes of Health are getting paid by the drug companies, studies that they're overseeing, until it's really understood the extent of the disorder of this, the way the public is disserved by the drug company takeover of our medical knowledge, there's going to be no action. So I think the first step is to become educated.
Before we go into sort of the implications of it, the drug lobby was able to insert a clause or a provision into the so-called discount card program as part of Medicare that prohibited the federal government from negotiating with the drug companies on bulk basis purchase of their stuff, as well as continuing to prohibit sales from Canada. And at the same time, they argue that they need the profits that we were talking about earlier, 18%, because it's such an expensive process to develop these miraculous drugs that if they were deprived of the right to make profits at that level, there would be no money for R&D, and therefore people would suffer because they'd be deprived of the next generation of powerful drugs to help and save them. What do you say to that?
Well, Mark, I'm going to ask you, I need an economics lesson.
Right.
Why do they have to earn four times more than the rest of the Fortune 500 companies, net of their research and development costs? In other words, including their research and development costs, are already in that.
Right.
Why do they need four times the profit to continue to do research and development?
Well,
Why wouldn't they do as much or more research development if they only made twice the profit of the other Fortune 500 companies, or even the same amount as the other Fortune 500 companies?
I think I don't want to exaggerate here either, but I think the reason why they say they're able to get those profits is the same reason why the torturers in Abu Ghraib said they did it because they could.
That's exactly right.
All right.
They could. We're the only country that doesn't control, the only industrialized country that doesn't control the price of drugs, and I think that really gets to the heart of the problem. Is medicine a commercial activity fundamentally, or is it an activity that's designed to improve our health? And at some point, our country's going to have to decide that. We cannot continue to be wasting $500 billion a year and going up on health care that's neutral or harmful to our health without destroying our own civilization, our own society.
Well, about 100 years ago, there was an argument about whether electricity ought to be a public utility or whether it should be privately owned. That discussion has never really been resolved one way or the other, and we kind of have a mixed system. But
we've seen what happened in California when power gets unregulated and not properly overseen.
Absolutely.
And that's what we have going on in medicine.
It's kind of like an Enron situation. Even if the books are honest, which I can't speak to.
I can't speak to that either, but I can say that the bias in what we think is the best medicine certainly drives up the cost of medicine and drives down the quality of the care.
Well, let me try to push you a little further here. Are you saying that there ought to be, beyond the institution of this organization, which you could give a name to if you want, if you haven't, to make it easy to remember, you were comparing
it
to the Federal Reserve
Board.
Well,
the UK has such an organization, and they have a nice name for it. It's the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, and they say nice.
Right.
I like that.
Right. And they have essentially the function that you've just outlined here for this group?
Yes, and it costs them $30 million a year.
And what kind of results is it showing?
They're coming up with very nice clinical programs. They say, for example, that there's no evidence that supports women getting bone mineral density tests because it doesn't improve their health. There are no controlled studies that show that. But there are very good studies that show that women should be counseled to exercise. Look at the real data, not the commercial data, but the real data on different issues, they make their recommendations.
So, but beyond proposing that there be this group whose stock in trade is information and proposals, would you suggest a further, again, this is a loaded word, socialization of the drug production and development process, according to which it would be treated more like a public utility, like water or electricity or gas, that in many places are offered as utilities and have a high level of service but aren't really in it for the profits? Or what kind of balance would you see between the private and public sectors working on drug development and production, not to mention, of course, all the work that NIH does publicly that gets commercialized by the drug companies, not to mention the plan here in California for a $3 billion investment, $6 billion after it's paid back, in StealthSem research, most of the profits of which will go to the biotech companies that will be getting the contracts in the first place.
Right. So, you know, you could argue that we already have a socialized system, that the government pays the drug companies a lot of money, public money, that they give away to help drug development. I'm not sure, Mark, and I'm not sure that, you could call it either way. We've got a free enterprise system, and I think it would be foolhardy to suggest throwing it away, but throwing away the baby with the bathwater. But I think it's clear that the drug companies can't referee their own game, so that if we're going to continue with this free enterprise system, and I assume we are, and I don't see that I'm not fundamentally opposed to it, but I do think that the government has the right and the obligation to make sure that the market is operating both on good information and that the public is getting appropriate value for what they're paying for these products.
Okay, more specifically, you're there in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Your senator is John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
He may become the next president. Do you know much about his views on these subjects, and tell me whether you expect any improvement under a Kerry administration?
Well, I think a Kerry administration would have a more compassionate health policy, so that there would be a ceiling on catastrophic bills at $30,000 or $50,000, so that the risk of serious disease would become distributed over all of society, not just on individuals. You probably know that more than half of personal bankruptcies are due to medical bills.
Right.
So I think that that's a good policy, and the idea of increasing the insurance, especially to uninsured children, through reinstituting some of the or revoking some of the tax breaks for the very wealthy people, I happen to support that. But I think that the primary issue is that if we just put more money into our healthcare system without straightening out the way our medical knowledge is generated and how doctors and patients come to think about the best medical care, it won't work. We're just going to keep spending more and more money. And to put this problem in perspective, tell me if you know this, but to put this problem in perspective, out of 22 industrialized countries, the United States spends more than twice the average.
Per capita.
Half again more than the second country, Switzerland. So we spend more than twice the average per capita of the other of 22 industrialized countries, and our health ranks dead last. Americans are going to live the fewest years of healthy life amongst the 22 countries.
Well, it would seem evident that the cost-effectiveness of the system is pretty low.
It's so low that the cost-effectiveness of our system is ranked 72nd in the world by the World Health Organization.
But I imagine that the drug companies have the highest profits of any.
That's exactly right. So then you say, well, you could say, if you were a naive idealist like I used to be, this system functions very poorly, why don't we make it function well? Or you could say that this system functions very well, we just think it's doing its purposes other than what it really is.
It does what it's designed to do very well.
It absolutely does.
But we need to reconsider what it's designed to do.
Right. Do we the American people want the primary function of our healthcare system to be to maximize profits for the medical corporations? Or do we, the American people, want the primary function of our healthcare system be to maximize our health most effectively and efficiently?
Well, that seems self-evident.
No, it's not, and it needs to be articulated. I mean, that's why we're talking on the phone right now, and that's why I've written the book.
All right, and that's why I'm saying everyone should go get a copy of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine, read it, and then contact the Kerry campaign and tell them to read it. And tell them to win. And
tell them to get on the populist issue. The American people hold the drug companies in about the same regard they hold the tobacco companies. So it's time for politicians to stop worrying about their campaign contributions and speak what they know is right for the American people, to save the drug companies from themselves, so that they don't get sued, so that they don't have to recall products that they've built their
reputation
their
on
repertoire
it.
around.
And in fact, they don't have to have their stock go down 20% in one day.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us, and hopefully we'll keep on this subject, and I'll see what I can do to get the Kerry campaign to pay more attention to it.
Great.
Thank you
very
much.
Good to talk to you, Mark.
Good to talk to you. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.